Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the office joined by Helen Lewis and Adam McQueen. We're here to tell you about everything that has happened since the last issue of the magazine came out, starting with you, Helen. You wanted to talk about Dark Starmer.
That makes it sound, I think, possibly more exciting than it's going to be. But Will Lloyd, a columnist for the New Statesman but writing in the Times, was talking about dark labour last week, which I thought was really interesting as a question about what Starmer would do as a kind of governing politician. And what he wrote about was the fact that during the 2011 riots, you know, as Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer was the one who set the precedent that people should be charged for burglary rather than theft, so much more aggressively prosecuted. So right. All those sentences where somebody got, you know, 6 months for nicking a water bottle,
yeah,
he oversaw all of that. Which is a really interesting insight into, you know, the thing that often makes a very successful Labour leader, upsetting as it is to me as a Liberal, is a sort of latent authoritarianism. So Tony Blair was incredibly authoritarian. He wanted to bring in ID cards and things like that. And someone once said that the perfect pitch for a Labour government is fund the NHS, hang the pedos. But just to give you background, I know you're very online, Andy, so you'll know where Dark Starmer comes from.
But for everyone else.
But for normal people who get out in the daytime, there was a meme that went around. Basically, in a NASCAR rally in America, somebody started chanting, fuck you, Biden. Yeah. And the commentator tried to pretend that they were shouting, let's go, Brandon, in reference to one of the drivers. So that became a very kind of popular way on the US right of insulting Joe Biden. However, Joe Biden embraced this with strange memes and lighting himself like Nosferatu to become Dark Brandon. And in a similar way, Keir Starmer sort of leaned into this idea that he's, you know, he is annoying the Labour left. So the other big thing that he's done recently is he praised Thatcher for trying to unleash the entrepreneurialism of Britons. Now, the point he was making is a reasonable one, right? Which is that there are some people who come into power without really any clue what they want to do, like Rishi Sunak, you might say, to some extent. And then there are generational change leaders like Thatcher, like Blair, like Clement Attlee. Unfortunately, the other person you could say recently who's come in with a very clear sense of what they want to do is Liz Truss. It just turned out that what she wanted to do was bad and no one liked it. But that was a kind of intervention, really, that was calculated to wind up the Labour left. So you can put it all together and it's this package of what Keir Starmer is trying to do, which is trying to sort of say, I'm right here, I'm in the centre, I'm in this place where lots of voters are, which is high levels of funding for public services, but also so strong on law and order. That's his kind of pitch to Britain, really, for the next election.
Something I saw recently about the idea that basically Starmer has won over presumably a fair few former Conservative or floating voters. Does he need to keep doing this? It was an argument that was being made. As in, is this really necessary? Could he have picked another generational change leader, or is Thatcher so dominant in UK politics that you sort of have to reference her?
Well, Adam, I'm interested in this because the really interesting thing about that first Thatcher election in 79 is you get a lot of people who would, I'm trying to think, whoever was director of the National Theatre at the time, Peter Hall, said he was going to vote for Thatcher. There were lots of sort of former lefties who just went, I really do think things are going very badly. We do need some kind of big change.
I love
change.
The fact this has been pitched. You've literally just described a load of online memes, which I sat here looking absolutely flabbergasted by and just going, what? What? And now you've thrown to me for my knowledge of the 1979 election. I have never felt older than I do this moment.
I'm throwing to you because of Adam's excellent books, which refer to the politics of the 1970s. But there was a feeling that the Labour government had not got the answers to the things that were wrong with Britain.
I think, to be honest, it was a bit like the atmosphere now with Rishi Sunak's government, that the government that we're in, it was James Callaghan who had taken over from Harold Wilson, who had looked, frankly, clapped out and tired for a very long time. And I think there was, as there quite often is in this country, as there was under Gordon Brown after Tony Blair as well, this sense of just a government has lost it and it's time for a change. I mean, politics in those days were crazy because this is also the point where it was pushed, the vote of no confidence in James Callaghan was pushed through by the SNP, who at that point were known as the Tartan Tories. So again, very, very different beast to what they were. And if I remember rightly, Mrs. Thatcher was still extremely pro-Europe at this point as well. So we really are talking about a kind of everything being different, but also in odd ways the same.
But that is interesting you mentioned the SNP, because one of the criticisms of Starmer is that he's got to win against the Tories in England and he's got to win against the SNP in Scotland. And the SNP has very squarely put itself out as a socially progressive and also a high-spending government. And so that's the kind of interesting thing about how do you try and like tailor your message to be slightly different. And by going too far to the centre in England, does he then turn off some of those maybe SNP switches in Scotland?
Presumably there are lots of bits of the north of England which don't remember Margaret Thatcher especially fondly.
No.
Which might be part of the red wall that he's trying to win back.
Well, the question about that is whether or not some of those people actually voted for Brexit and then some of them voted Tory in 2019. Mm. So I think that's the feeling, is that, yes, I agree with you, there are people for whom the mention of Mrs. Thatcher's name is sort of a kind of moment, but that other people perhaps have now, that has sort of cycled through to some extent.
There is a recurrent thing, though. This is what always happens. I mean, Tony Blair certainly played tribute to Mrs. Thatcher in the interruption of the 97 election. Gordon Brown had her out for tea. It was one of the first things he did when he moved into Downing Street in 2007. The bizarre thing, she was quite far gone with Alzheimer's at that point and had to be sort of guided in and explained that she didn't actually live there anymore. But it does seem to be a thing, a button that Labour leaders of a certain hue can't resist pressing. And basically, it's Keir Starmer trolling a lot of his party, this, isn't it?
That was my assumption. Was that the year in which Margaret Thatcher also used to go to Stringfellows a lot?
She did, didn't she? Yeah. I was thinking it was before she moved into the Ritz, courtesy of the Barclays, but yeah.
It was a strange... She must have been like, well, the strippers, bring back the strippers. Don't make me talk to Gordon Brown.
I'm now looking at you both with the same expression that Adam had when you were explaining Dark Brandon.
It was a particularly mad period of policy. Peter Stringfellow was briefly sort of quite a significant political figure on the right. Do you remember when everyone was courting Simon Cowell? And decided that he was the future of democracy.
No.
Basically, because the X Factor was a huge thing. Gordon Brown used to do little videos commenting on who'd won the X Factor each week and how well Susan Boyle was and things. It was very, very peculiar. And basically, they were pitching it to Simon Cowell on the grounds that he ran a show where they had votes and that this might be a good way to sort of get young people excited about democracy again.
Well, we're probably going to talk a bit about I'm a Celebrity later, where Nigel Farage is currently making the running and accruing more votes than he ever has done before in his life, you know.
It's very, very funny, because basically he was caught on camera saying, I'm upset I'm not getting selected for any of the Bush Tucker trials, because that's, quotes, 25% of the airtime. So what the premise of I'm a Celebrity is, you vote on people who you want to upset and make unhappy by making them eat kangaroo anus. And it turns out that, unfortunately, we've all discovered that Nigel Farage is such a credit whore that he would love to be eating kangaroo anus, because at least people would be looking at him. So people have decided to punish him by not making him eat kangaroo anus.
Is that true? Is that a decision that the viewers have made?
He's not being selected for a lot of Bush Tucker trials at all. He did one where he had it in a tank that he bailed out of. He just couldn't handle being in the water. But he's been selected for really very, very few.
Is that because Matt Hancock was selected for all of them last year when he was in and then ended up coming third?
Yeah, I think the people have got wise to the fact that some people really, the worst thing for them is not having to have spiders run all over them. It's simply sitting in the corner alone with their thoughts. Your reference to Gordon Brown made me think of, do you remember, didn't Tony Blair get involved in the sentencing of Deirdre Barlow?
He certainly did, yeah. Deirdre Rashid, as she was then. Prime Minister's question.
I'm going to need just a little bit more than that.
So there's a popular hit combo called Coronation Street, on which there's a character called Deirdre. Now, what crime had she committed?
This is all happening to Deirdre, the character, not to the actor.
Yes, so
this is
fictional. Yes.
The TLDR is that she did a crime in Coronation Street.
She didn't do a crime. That's the whole point of it. She was wrongly jailed for a crime that was committed. Tony Blair stood up at Prime Minister's Questions and said, "Free the Weatherfield One." It was a huge campaign.
Is part of this people just trying to get their bosses to say amusing things in speeches and in briefing notes?
Well, this ties back in brilliantly to what we were saying about draconian hardline Labour leaders, because the question was then bounced to his Home Secretary, who I think at that point was Jack Straw, who at that point was known as Jack Boot Straw, who said, no, you know, no sentencing guidelines. It was all taken ridiculously seriously. Jack Straw, basically, I think at that point, was his policy was kind of put everyone in prison, be they fictional or not. But he was followed, of course, as his Home Secretary by David Blunkett, who was, you know, about as right-wing a Home Secretary as you could possibly get. So it very much does... Oh, do you know what I'm doing here? I'm bringing us back round to the topic on which we started via Deirdre Rashid.
Because David Blunkett was one of the champions of indeterminate sentences for public protection, right? Which was the idea that if if your crime is related to kind of having alcohol or something like that, that you might then kind of have your license conditions or whatever it might be. But there's now since turned against them and they sort of said, well, actually, they're incredibly illiberal. And I sort of regret being involved in that. But you're right. There was a kind of moment where the greatest thing you could do as a new Labour Home Secretary was basically say, let me tell you, you should be banged up. People on telly that you've heard of. Mm. That's who we are.
And it was the age of the Asbo, wasn't it? It was, you know, if any of you so much as looked as policeman funny, you should have an antisocial behaviour order put upon you. It's very much the Labour line, I think.
You young people, Andy, you just don't remember this sort of thing.
Excuse me, I got six Asbos. No, I didn't. So it seems to be working.
Well, that's the really funny thing is that, you know, there's been lots of discussion about does he really need to keep wooing these people? And it comes back to the fact that Keir Starmer doesn't sort of fundamentally believe in his bones that Labour are as ahead as the polls show them to be.
Right.
So there are lots of questions about what the polls are showing. So, for example, the amount of, you know, people who are saying they're going to vote for the Reform Party. Mm. And there is a theory advanced by my former colleague Stephen Bush now at the FT that that is a kind of placeholder for men who are either going to go back to voting for the Conservative Party or men who simply cannot say, I don't know, which are one of the greatest constants in all the polling, right? If you ask people to what they think of a cabinet minister who doesn't exist, men are much more likely to go, doing a great job, phenomenal,
right,
rather than saying, I'm sorry, I haven't heard of that person. So there is a theory that some of that reform number might be soft. Some of those people might go back to the Tories.
Because it's between 5 and 15% in various different polls who say that they're supporting reform, which obviously would make an enormous difference come election time.
Huge difference. I mean, yeah, it could be, not because that would translate into reform MPs, but because that would be the difference between the first and second places. It might wipe out those gains. So the point is, although Keir Starmer looks like he's, you know, everything in the polls says that he's going home with like 450 MPs next time, but no one in Westminster believes it because they can't kind of let themselves, not only because it would make all commentary very boring, but because it is one of those things that is like a black swan event. It just seems so out of touch with everything else that has happened before that people just are having trouble processing it.
So what can we look for next from Dark Starmer?
I think where he puts himself on immigration is probably the big question, because even lots of the smarter commentators on the Tory side have said that, you know, the Rwanda boats policy is a huge strategic error. It should have been ditched. It's fundamentally seen as pretty cruel by most people. Worse even than that to voters, it's seen as not effective. And at the same time, you're having this situation where you're talking about stopping the boats and then failing to do so. Legal migration has increased absolutely enormously and is a record high. So, you know, where he positions himself in relation to that is really, really tough. Yeah. Because you've got a Tory party that has simultaneously overseen an enormous uptick in migration while also being rhetorically extremely anti-immigration. And where does that leave you as the Labour leader to put yourself?
Yeah.
Do you remember the incredible furore over Ed Miliband and his stance on immigration, which came down, and again, in the weirdness of politics, came down to a mug mostly, didn't it? Which was a bit of merchandise put out by the Labour Party that said, it had a line about immigration that wasn't even particular, and it wasn't stop the boats or anything like that, but it caused incredible controversy amongst Labour supporters.
Yeah.
So it is a very, very difficult line to balance that one.
Yeah. But it is, I mean, I think legal migration is something like 30 times the size of the boats crossing the channel, roughly.
700,000 net.
The boats are about 3% of that.
And it was about 300,000 before the pandemic. You know, that's about the time of the Brexit vote. So it's massive. And the problem with it is, really, there are lots of people out of work, 1.5 million people out of work, often with long-term sickness. You know, the NHS waiting lists are contributing to that problem because there are people out there, you know, they just can't work because they need a hip replacement, whatever it might be. They're stuck on those waiting lists. There's people with sort of effectively forms of long COVID who've never been quite right since the pandemic. So at the same time that we've got this labour market that's crying out for people to be in jobs, basically, we haven't got the British people to fill them. So the people that are coming in are working in industries like care also that are incredibly badly paid, but those people are often bringing dependents with them. That's one of the things that's boosting up the numbers. So instead of your kind of stereotypical young guy from Eastern Europe who's coming over to work in the construction trade, you are having someone more like a care worker from Nigeria or India who's coming over with a couple of kids. So that's the balance of immigration has also changed, I think, in the last couple of years.
That was always a point made by people who are in favour of immigration, is that people are coming for the working bits of their life. They're actually coming for the bits where they're paying into the state, they're paying tax and national insurance, rather than the beginning or end of their lives. So that slightly changes the argument if you've got people bringing in dependents who are, for example, children or elderly.
It's just a really hilarious irony that, you know, we've had a Tory government for 13 years that was anti-immigration. We've ended up with record immigration, and that was all about tax cutting, and we've ended up with incredibly high burdens of tax. Sort of, this is exactly what we did not want to happen.
Well, speaking of things steadily getting worse, let's turn from British affairs to international ones now, because COP28 is on. We've had this is so exciting.
Cheery podcast. Happy Christmas, everyone.
Feeling cold now? You won't be when the climate's ruined and everything's hotter.
No, good news, because actually the wild swings in weather will, you know, could theoretically lead to Europe being much colder lots of the time. Anyway, look, the point is, COP is on. And we've had the first 2 days of the World Climate Action Summit, which is where the leaders turn up and they make their speeches. They do their kind of grandstanding and glad-handing. And then we're now right in the middle of the 10 days of negotiations that follow, the sort of actual grinding out of commitments and what countries are willing to agree to, and you know, the sort of real details where you try and end up with a statement that everyone's happy with.
Can I ask you a very basic question,
yeah.
which is what I like to do with people who actually know something about the topic they're talking about, which is where on my like scariness dial am I, and in which direction is the dial moving as a result of COP? Because they were talking about the fact that the climate change, the temperature rise targets look like they might have to be junked. Is that happening?
No, they're not being junked as yet. So the overall aim of the summits is to keep the temperature rise from pre-industrial times, between pre-industrial times and now, to 1.5 degrees, which doesn't sound like a lot. But as we've seen at the moment, we're currently at roughly 1.2 degrees on average. And that has caused a lot of sea ice melt, a lot of biodiversity loss, a lot more fires. So 1.2 is bad. 1.5 will be worse. But beyond 1.5, things seem to get worse even faster, according to the models. So the overriding aim is to keep things to 1.5. It's going to be incredibly difficult to do, and the pathway to doing it is very slim because there isn't very much carbon left to emit before you've kind of locked in that 1.5. You know, there was a letter actually in the last issue of the Mag about you can't really negotiate with the melting point of ice. In terms of how scared to be, and in terms of which direction the dial's moving, there have been lots of moves, lots of announcements made in the early days, which have seemed quite positive. Lots of countries, about 120, committing to triple their renewable capacity by 2030. The fact that this year's COP is happening in Dubai is a kind of mixed one. I mean, it's not great. Sultan Al-Jaber, who's the head of COP this year, is the head of ADNOC, which is the state oil producer. But he's also the head of Masdar, which is the state, which is a huge renewable firm, and did that 20 years ago. There have been lots of stories. I think The Guardian broke a great one about them seeking fossil fuel deals on the side. Not a great sign. In fact, a really, really, really bad sign, which he's, of course, denied.
That's interesting that he's head of both of them, because that has always been my kind of hunch, is that the energy transition will have to be led by the current fossil fuel companies, right? And it's up to governments and public pressure to make it worth their while to move into the technologies of the future.
I don't know if it'll be led by them, because their products are so profitable.
It's been in the picture a long time. Remember when BP suddenly said, we're not British Petroleum anymore, we're beyond petroleum.
Yeah, they haven't quite managed to get beyond yet.
But you know what I mean? That without them shifting, even if they budge an inch, that's kind of huge. I take your point. They're not going to do it on their own, because at the moment the business is very good.
Yeah, it's a really complicated one, because they probably need to be involved at some level, but they are not going to do it on their own. And also you've got the complicating factor of these are voluntary, you know, arrangements. This is a document everyone signs up to. Lots of people, huge producers, Russia, China, India, are not willing to make announcements about phasing out fossil fuels, which ultimately is what you're going to need to happen. So it's tricky. You are seeing a thing where you're getting lots of smaller groups of countries kind of teaming up. There is a group called the Powering Past Coal Alliance, which is a small number of countries which have decided, like, coal is really dirty, really bad for the environment. Let's get rid of it. And America has just joined, which is huge, because they are the third biggest burner of coal on the planet after China and India.
Is huge. And also because lots of swing states in the Senate are coal-powered, like I'm going to say off the top of my head, West Virginia. But there is a lot of disincentive for them to do anything about
production. But at the same time, the coal use in the electricity mix has been really declining precipitously, even in states like West Virginia, which is, you know, interesting and a positive sign. So you've got these kind of... It's why COP is so hard to report on, because it's enormous. There are lots of different bits. There are nationally determined contributions. There's a ratchet mechanism. All of this stuff is kind of voluntary anyway, apart from the few countries which have signed up to it in law, the UK being one of them, which is a good thing.
Is everyone there? Sorry. I mean, are all countries signed up to this? I mean, Russia and China are part of COP, are they?
Everyone's there, yeah. Everyone, it's a UN thing.
That's quite an achievement, isn't it, in itself?
Well,
in the state of the world at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's a UN thing, so they're all present, you know. Mm. But obviously you get curveballs thrown in, people withdrawing statements at the last minute saying, no, we're not going to sign up to a phase out of coal, it's going to be a phase down. That was a huge thing at the last COP held in the UK, which was 2 years ago.
And how binding is whatever they agree in the end of it?
It's not.
Right.
So countries have all come up with their nationally determined contributions, right, which are their own targets. Those were come up with after Paris, which is where the 1.5 target came from. They're not binding, and even at the time it was acknowledged they weren't sufficient, right? So there is a ratchet mechanism where every several years countries would have to bring new targets and increase their ambitions to cut emissions. that has been accelerated. So now it's every year or so that they're going to have to provide new data and increase their ambitions to what is necessary. The aim is to do as much as possible this decade, because obviously the more you cut now...
Yes, it's like saving into a pension, right, earlier is better. Which, because I was just thinking about this.
And also this like feeling of absolute doom that you're going to be completely screwed when you're old.
Oh dear, yeah.
They also cut in sense of, I know we talk a lot about tipping points when it comes to climate, but there is one where actually it becomes more expensive to not do stuff. So yeah. I was reporting earlier this year in Florida where there is a consistent problem that the insurance market now just simply won't insure people to build properties on the beach. I think the thing is, like, once it's, you know, two hurricanes have taken your house out, then frankly you're on your own, and the state is being expected to kind of pick up that bill. And the same thing, you know, even in kind of much more individualistic America, there is a point that people are individually noticing that, you know, there are wildfires every summer and they cannot get their home insured or whatever it might be. And at that point then, that, you know, I think that it's really sad, isn't it, but I just feel like it has to get worse before it gets better, in the sense that people have to feel that. You don't hear a lot from the super denialists anymore, do you? That's one of the things I think has definitely happened in the time that I've been in journalism. You don't hear people, do not go on about the hockey stick graph and is the anthropogenic climate change really real anymore? Like, that's sort of marginalised. Because I spend a lot of time on these weird bits of the online right who absolutely love a conspiracy theory, the blue church, the scientists are all conspiring against us. And they're very into whatever it might be, you know, COVID vaccines are all fake or whatever it is. But actually, there is not the energy there was 10 years ago in climate change denialism.
No, it's moved on. It's moved on from it's not happening to we can't do anything about it.
Which well, is it's great progress. There's also an element which is very much in that conspiracy mindset, isn't there, of what we are doing about it is nonsense and won't help anyway, because that's the argument for a lot of people against ULEZ, isn't it? That actually this is not going to help at all with any targets and it's not about climate change.
It's an argument that gets used a lot, and I think people who are very keen on doing something about it try and perceive it more as an engineering challenge. You know, you've got to build a power system that is largely or entirely renewable based. How do you do it? It's a challenge engineering wise because those are intermittent, but it's not impossible. So why not do it?
Well, that comes back to my strange love of both Arnold Schwarzenegger and Elon Musk and what they're doing with electric cars, which is not, you have to have an electric car because you know, otherwise the planet will burn and the baby pandas will die, but you should have an electric car because it's awesome. And that is a change in tone. I think the climate change movement realised that going, oh my God, we're all going to die, actually introduced a sort of sense of apathy and ennui in people. And instead, like, yay, renewables are awesome.
People realised that LED light bulbs actually last for ages and you don't have to buy lots of light bulbs. Was the point where that argument sort of flipped over,
wasn't
it? The
Daily Mail campaign against the low energy light bulbs. Oh,
yes,
that was...
It's moving from hair shirts to green silk. Is basically the premise. But I think the interesting thing, certainly for our purposes, is that much like with Dark Starmer, Rishi Sunak is really pitching both ways. To the extent that I find this so interesting, during those first 2 days when he turned up, there was much play in the press that he turned up for, I think, 11 hours.
Got insulted by the king. Yeah.
And then, you know, the flights were slightly longer than 11 hours, basically, to and from Dubai. So he was in the air on a private jet longer than he was on the ground solving the problem. And
that's number crunching sorted for the next issue.
His exquisite sense of the common touch of, why don't I take a private jet to my climate change summit? It's beautiful.
I think it was that David Cameron and the King all flew on separate private jets, which does feel like a logistics error.
It's one of those things where it's like, oh, but what if they all got taken out at the same time if you put them on the same jet? And you're like, I think we'd probably struggle on. I'm very sad for their families, but I don't think Britain would collapse. Anyway.
The interesting thing was that when he arrived, he made two speeches, right? The first one he made was basically to political correspondents, and lots of other hacks were not allowed in. It was a closed door event. And I've spoken to some of the climate journalists who were at the event and not allowed in.
Can I say that is a absolutely classic thing to do in politics? And with no disrespect to the lobby, but the lobby report things tend to, in the personality tone and in the sense of like their job, they feel their job is just to get down what was said and put that on the record. And classically, if you exclude the specialist correspondence, that's a sign you don't have a huge amount of faith in your ability to deal with the second question on a technical level.
Well, that's exactly it. So basically, climate correspondents had to like find a live feed of it happening elsewhere in the Thunderdome of COP and watch that and couldn't ask any questions. And the speeches he made were different in tone. So the speech he made to everybody was much more emollient. You know, some of the lines were the same, but he didn't mention China. Which he did in his speech for effectively UK political correspondents, and he did mention how, you know, we can't tackle climate change unless we take people with us. There were two very different tones of voice that he used, which kind of is indicative of where I think the whole party, his party, is on it. Oh, we do want to be seen to be doing the right thing on this, but also We don't, and we have reversed lots of moves. Yeah.
I think also equally indicative was the third move, which was the trump card he played on the way back, which was to say, BBC is going to have to make a lot more cuts, you know, people can't afford the licence fee. And suddenly every front page of the right-wing press is, whoa, it's BBC bashing season again. Fantastic.
I think there's a problem with that Sunak approach, because it reminded me when I was reading the papers this morning of the problem of that Labour has classically had, which is, we know you'd love full socialism now, but unfortunately you can't have it. And that is never a good pitch for a Labour Party to kind of go in to an election with. It was kind of Miliband's problem that he went in with that sort of like, you have to have a diet version, sorry, because that's the only thing we can kind of get past people. And I feel like the Tory party now are doing that. You see quotes from MPs where they say like, well, obviously there's lots of stuff we'd have to do, but we're being held back by X, Y or Z. And instead of making the case for sort of moderation and as a positive force, saying, well, obviously we're not giving you the real stuff, but that's because you can't have it for X, Y, Z reasons. It always feels slightly pathetic, and I'm not sure it ever entirely works. You know, you should be fighting things you actually believe in rather than saying you can't, you know, I'm going to give you a kind of crap watered down version.
It does seem to piss off everybody. And this is the thing with saying, well, what about China? They do much worse than we are. And you know, we did loads. We cut out coal in the 90s. It does feel a bit bleaty. As in, either go red meat, I mean, please don't, but, you know, or...
or go vegan.
Yeah, I mean...
I know what you mean, but the thing is that Cameron could go out there, this is the joy of having him back, I guess, as Foreign Secretary, and go out and say, look, when there's no solution to climate change, it doesn't rely on engaging with China, right? So we have to go out and do it. And you make the positive case about the fact that unless we take China with us, it's all doomed, rather than saying, we all know China's the problem, but we can't do anything about China. Because then it's just not appealing, is it, as a political kind of message?
It doesn't feel powerful, I guess. Okay, let's move on now to our final story. And Adam, you wanted to talk about... We're back in the UK, there is a story with a Middle Eastern angle, actually. We're not completely back from COP.
We are not. We could be going even closer to the UAE. Yes, this is, of course, what you would think from reading most of the newspapers, and I'm afraid the last issue of Private Eye was the only story in town, the most important thing in the world. We did an entire page pointing out what everyone else had been saying about it. But this is the... sale of the Telegraph to a fund backed by the UAE, who the United Arab Emirates, who may or may not have editorial control over things. And in fact, everything about this is incredibly complicated because it's not really the sale either. It's a very, very Barclay family manoeuvre.
You explained this to me and I swear I understood it for a second. So let me go. It is basically that the company collapsed. It was massively in debt. So the UAE might now refinance the debt, allowing the Barclays to then buy it again. But it's therefore not technically UAE takeover, it's a Barclay takeover, but the money comes from...
As we speak, so things have moved on quite significantly since the last issue of the Eye came out. As we speak, I believe that the fund has paid back the debts which the Barclays owed to Lloyds Bank and had owed for about 12 years and had not been paying them, but nevertheless looked quite surprised when suddenly they got their newspapers taken off them back in the summer. At the moment, as things sit, the UAE people have taken on the debt, but they don't yet get the papers. The idea is that the Barclays will then hand over both Telegraph titles and The Spectator to them, and they will take them over. What the Barclays get out of this, I'm not quite sure, other than the feeling that they've done an incredibly clever deal, which was aimed at getting past the regulators' backs. But the other development is that their cunning plan has not worked, because it was announced late last week that Lucy Fraser, the Culture Secretary, is referring the deal to the authorities and it will be subject to an investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority and by Ofcom.
So, that investigation, is that about the fact that it would be foreign-owned or backed by foreign money, the Telegraph?
It's not necessarily just about foreign money. I mean, whoever takes over the Telegraph, ultimately, there is likely to have to be some sort of investigation into it, because the other bidders who are in there are the Daily Mail Group. And if the Daily Mail Group were to take over both Telegraph titles, that would mean that they owned the Daily Mail as well, the Metro, which everyone forgets about, which is, I think, pretty much the highest circulation newspaper in the country, largely because it's free. And also The Eye, the newspaper that they took on from Johnson Press a few years ago. So that's enormous watch of the newspaper market, much more than Murdoch had when, you know, the subject of, again, going back into history, but when he took over The Times in the 1980s.
Sorry, but that can't be the justification for this investigation, because that's not the bid that's gone through.
This investigation is more about power being handed over potentially to a foreign... foreign investor, but also someone with links to a overseas regime, specifically the United Arab Emirates in this case. And the precedent for that one is, if you remember, when Yevgeny Lebedev, Britain's favourite comedy press proprietor, handed over half of his, both the Independent and the Standard, to investors from Saudi. who slightly mysterious figures who may or may not have had connections to the Saudi royal family. And that one, in the end, much to Yevgeny's fury, was referred to the authorities to look into. And in the end, they decided that actually that deal was probably okay.
I'm just going to call it, but if they were wealthy Saudis wanting to invest in Britain, then they did have connections to the Saudi royal family. I mean, the Saudi royal family is huge for a start, isn't it? So, yes.
And I mean, again, it's not just newspapers. I mean, the Qatari royal family own enormous swathes of London, don't they? I think the Shard belongs to the Qataris. I think half of the hotels that, again, we come back to them, used to be the Barclays were in the running for, have also gone to funds connected to the Qatari royal family. So, you know, there are all sorts of concerns about things being handed over to.
Okay, so but the deal has so far gone through, and obviously pending the investigation.
Well, this deal, which isn't quite a deal, this is the kind of back. This is the bit about the debts, the actual ownership of the newspapers. Currently, so I don't believe has
the
changed.
UAE might end up refinancing the Barclays, which I don't see what they managed to get out of it, and then they might then fail to take.
They might then
the
not be allowed to take over the Telegraph,
and then essentially
in which case
the
Barclays just sort of skip off into the sunset.
Right. The UAE just essentially have a note saying, "Soz, we spent all the money.
Yeah,
we promise we'll
pay
back." We
got that, and we didn't give any of it to Sir Frederick Barclay's wife, despite the divorce findings that she was owed £100 million, and the Barclays are claiming complete poverty throughout all of this and can't repay her.
How did this debt build up in the first place from the Barclays? How on earth do you get £1 billion in debt from a profitable newspaper?
Not
group?
From the Telegraph at all. This is the point. The Telegraph is a profitable newspaper, as you say, largely because it's been been cut to the bone over so many years and kind of looted for profit rather than any investment going back into it. The problem is the other side of the Barclays business, which was various kind of mail order businesses and delivery firms like, I believe, Yodel, which have not done very well at all. So essentially, they were forced to kind of refinance those over the last decade to take out enormous debts against their one profitable asset, which was the newspapers.
It's an interesting insight, this whole bidding process, into who wants to own a newspaper and why. Because as you say, the three main bids, I see it, are one, the Barclays, refinanced by foreign money, two, the Daily Mail Group, and Lord Rothermere was out giving an interview saying, actually, we don't, even if we owned all of this, we'd still be a small market because online now exists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we could own all the newspapers and you still wouldn't be speaking to that many people a day. And then the kind of Paul Marshall of Unheard's kind of consortium as well, which also, you know, he's got stakes in GB News and Unheard, so he would be kind of consolidating a media empire too. Mm. But there's, you know, there is a kind of larger question about why in this day and age do you want to own a newspaper?
I just point out that argument doesn't really work with Rothermere because he also owns the Daily Mail website, which is one of the biggest websites in the world and is enormous in America. So
I was speaking to someone who sells art for a living recently, and quite high-end art, and basically he said there is a problem, which is that all the tech bros are not interested in art even whatsoever. It's not a question of their taste changing what's in vogue in the art world, it's that they don't care. You know, if it's not a gif of a bored ape, they're not interested. And so when you get to this question of newspapers, it's always been eccentric people who have a lot of money and who would like to slightly influence empire.
When I was at the New Statesman, we had a tie-up where we did some content sharing with the New Republic, which is a very august leftist magazine in the US. And for a while, it was owned by Chris Hughes, who was one of the early Facebook investors. You know, he's part of that class of people who were lucky enough to be mates with Mark Zuckerberg and then by money raining upon them. And, you know, it was a pretty unhappy time, actually. You know, he had visions about how it was going to be super digital and it was going to make all this money. And then he discovered, as most people do, that actually the margins on media are not amazing. You can run a kind of, you know, a nice profitable business like the Telegraph if you're very extremely lean. But what you can't do is make money on the scale of a Facebook or a YouTube, where you're essentially creaming off a bit of advertising revenue over huge amounts of content that someone else makes for you and you lightly regulate. So I think there has been a feeling that by the tech guys with lots of money to throw around, that this is a very old-fashioned business with not really very much excitement, not very much scalability, and not very much, you know, profit margin on
but it.
It
has always been the case that, I mean, newspapers, or probably we should refer to them now, media brands, they've never been, for most people, about making enormous amounts of money. They have been about two things. They've been about prestige, you know, owning the London Times was very good for Rupert Murdoch in his search for respectability, and about power, because it gets you that seat at the top table. If it doesn't get you a seat in the war cabinet, as it did for Beaverbrook, then, you know, it does get you those meetings at Downing Street.
I don't want Yevgeny Lebedev in the war cabinet.
I mean, he's in the House of Lords, yes, so, you know, it is.
That's like a Doctor Who plot, isn't it? It's just like, hang on, what happened here? So, you know, like the last Doctor Who, he comes back to Earth and like, it's all in an apocalypse meltdown. You imagine him stepping out the TARDIS and going, let me just tell you, Evgeny Yevnev's in the war cabinet. You go, an asteroid? Like, what happened?
The other development, actually, I should say, that's also happened since we went to press is that the Telegraph have come out, themselves have come out big time against this deal. We've had several Telegraph journalists on record saying they think it's a terrible idea and they should not be handled.
Other newspapers were all criticising the deal, partly because they thought their own proprietors might be bidding, or they actively were already known to be interested. Mm. But the Telegraph have come out strongly against their own prospective new owners. What is
Charles
going on?
Moore has been sent into bat, ex Telegraph editor, and still has a two columns, I think, a week in the Telegraph pages. He was all over the BBC saying this is an absolutely terrible thing. Camilla Tominey, who also has a berth on GB News, so again, not entirely disinterested since Paul Marshall is one of the other bidders, the owner of GB News, wants the Telegraph. And yesterday, Janet Daly in the Sunday Telegraph devoted her entire column to it as well, which was then followed up in the Daily Mail. I mean, in terms of the media eating itself, and I know this is pretty rich coming from someone who writes Street of Shame pages, but the Daily Mail running half a page on Janet Daly writing a column in the Sunday Telegraph saying that the Telegraph should not be sold, your head does kind of start to spin.
But on whose behalf are these Telegraph columnists slagging off the new prospective deal? Are they not worried about losing their jobs if it goes through?
Well, I get the feeling that actually the preferred route at the Telegraph would be very much to go to Paul Marshall. That's absolutely ties into the editorial line. Well, half of their staff have also, I mean, Camilla Tominey, Christopher Hope has gone over to
DB
News as well.
But why would you write an article slagging it off? I don't understand.
Well, I think they're still thinking it won't.
Maybe they've got principles.
Come on, Helen. Come on. I know this is a comedy podcast, but give me a break.
Also, I suppose, you know, you're hedging your bets, because if it does happen and every kind of guarantee has been given that there will be no editorial interference, if you then sack all the people who spoke against it, it doesn't look good as a starting point.
But you're
it?
Right. You might end up in a kind of Andrew Neil space then, mightn't you? Like, if you genuinely do believe that them taking it over would lead to a loss of editorial independence and lots of very dodgy stuff swilling in, don't you want to be out ahead of having kind of called
well,
that?
Well, yes. Are they making themselves unsackable by criticising the deal and therefore ensuring they can't be sacked by a vengeful new proprietor because of how bad it would look?
I'm unclear that works. I think you just get, if you're involved in the union organising, you do tend to just get sacked in the media, unfortunately.
Okay. That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Helen and Adam for all their contributions, particularly the Deirdre Barlow stuff, which was certainly news to me. If you have enjoyed this episode and you'd like to read the magazine, you can go to your local newsstand or you can go to private-eye.co.uk and click on subscribe. Our next episode will be our annual Christmas bonanza, so tune in, check your podcast feed daily for when that might be coming out. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.